You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I feel like who Art Ed?
I'm trying to spice it.
Who Art Ed? Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on art. So many levels.
I know.
That's off to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, weekly art history for all ages. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and today my guest is actually the subject of last week's episode. So if you haven't listened to that, I highly recommend go back and listen to the episode about Tom Deslongchamp. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Hi, everybody.
I am like so excited to be talking to you just because you and I have actually corresponded a little bit for like a year now through emails and stuff, but this is our first time actually talking in sync. And I make it no secret, I absolutely love your work. I am like on a mission to, you know, teach other fellow art teachers about how awesome your marker drawings are. And you know, 20 years from now, there's going to be a generation of people collecting your work. I know you are going to be in the museums, if I can do anything about it.
Wow, Kyle, thank you. I'm a little bit overwhelmed by that statement, but I mean, I appreciate you championing my work and in sharing the process with other people because, yeah, it's sometimes, you know, people that have even followed me for years and followed my Instagram are suddenly like, wait, you use your fingertips for these? And I'm like, yeah, I talk about it once in a while, but it's not like something I hammer home every time I post to something, you know, so it's like, but yeah, anyways, but thank you. Appreciate that.
I just always love when I see something that catches me a little bit by surprise, but it doesn't feel like a cheap gimmick. It feels like it was just a clever way of using the material to get a different effect, you know? And you found a way to bring texture to a marker, and I love that. I mean, it looks and feels like a painting or a pastel drawing, and yet it's marker. I think that's really cool, and I love the drawings, and I am going to be, you know, talking about it probably for the next 20 years. So
thank you.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that you were willing to come on because I do something a little bit different. I didn't bring you on to talk about your work. I brought you on to talk about another artist. Today, we're going to be talking about Bob Ross because you said he was one of the influences on you growing up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I spent a lot of time watching him on TV when I was a kid. Yeah, it was one of those, you know, it was Channel 9 where I lived. And I remember just flipping through the channels and sometimes it'd be Mr. Rogers, sometimes it was Bob Ross, you know, just those childhood TV personalities. Yeah.
It's interesting that like Mr. Rogers is the other one you pull up because the two of them are just like the most calming, soothing male figures I can remember from, you know, television personalities on, I guess, both probably public television too. But yeah, Bob Ross, I think you're not the only one. He's been influencing generations and still continues to inspire people today. So I guess let's get into it. His early life, Bob Ross was born October 29th, 1942, in Daytona Beach, Florida. So we've got an episode about Florida Man here. And I love this. I did not realize this till I started doing research and watched the documentary and all of that. He didn't start off as an artist going to art school or anything like that. He actually enlisted in the military. He was in the Air Force, like starting from the age 18, and he spent like a full career, 20 years. He was a medical records technician. I saw something where he said basically he spent all that time in the military yelling at people about having to fix things and get it straightened out and all of that. And he said when he got out of there, he just wanted to adopt a totally different tone. He didn't want to be so harsh and yelling at people about everything.
This part of his life always inspires me, because everybody who's interested in making art, even if they're not a designated artist, will struggle with the fact that they have to do the things they have to do, like go to a regular job or something that's completely the opposite direction. But this, it proves that sometimes the things that you're not excited about push you towards something that you are, and eventually you'll get there, you know?
Yeah. He took on some odd jobs. Like, I guess one of the things I saw, he was working as a bartender to make a little extra money on the side, and he would paint landscapes that he saw and kind of sell those. But he didn't have a lot of like formal training in art. Towards the end of that time, while he's in Alaska, he was in a bar and saw a PBS television show come on, and it was Bill Alexander with The Magic of Painting, or The Magic of Oil Painting. And this really inspired Bob, because he said that he had been looking for art teachers, you know, in classes that could teach him technique. And I'm sure, well, I guess I shouldn't make assumptions. I'm guessing your training may have been similar to mine. Like, when I went to art school, a lot of the talk was more about like concepts. What are you addressing? Oh, yeah. How do you compose it? It wasn't a ton of specific technique. You almost had to seek that out. Like, I remember I would talk to different teachers and just be like, I am not really getting how to do X, Y, and Z. Like, how thin do I need to get the oil paint to be able to flow and get it to drip in this way? You know, whatever it might be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I relate with that too, in my experience, where the teachers were trying to create potential teachers and potential directors and potential like people that could direct ideas, and going really deep into one process. I mean, sometimes that was sort of like, well, we don't have time for that. Oh, I need to, you know.
I would say art since the 20th century has been so conceptually driven. It's gotten away from like the atelier system, like the apprenticeships that people had, you know, in the Renaissance on, where people were, you know, going to study in an artist studio, and they would go from the basic levels of like, I'm grinding up the stones to make the pigment and mix the paints, and then I'm doing like the washes, and then I'm priming and stretching canvases or whatever, up until they got to that point of mastery where they could execute their own paintings, you know, studying under a quote unquote master artist. You know, when we saw the shift towards, I would put it more like mid to late 19th century, as we went towards like the Impressionists and those people who were so direct and more about the ideas that they were capturing instead of the techniques, mm-hmm. art school really fundamentally changed. And I think Bob Ross was not super on board with that. He wanted to just learn how to paint. And he found that in Bill Alexander, who had a PBS television show just like Bob Ross did, and taught classes just like Bob Ross did. In fact, he taught Bob Ross, and, you know, he learned a lot from that process. And I guess after he finished and retired from the military, Bob Ross actually worked for a while as a traveling salesman for Bill Alexander in his paint company. And then he was teaching classes, teaching the Alexander method, painting, you know, Primavera wet on wet, that sort of quick study method, before he got his own show and his own break.
That's a wild story. I mean, I feel like when you have a television show, it's about not just that you can paint, it's your personality. You're a person that likes to entertain and display. And man, it just, I know that there were, I mean, when he just took Bill Alexander's methods and then ran with them, I mean, that's exciting because we all learn from each other, but it seemed a little bit intense too.
Well, yeah, it started off, I think, more friendly, because in the early days, like I said, Bob Ross was teaching a sort of Bill Alexander workshop, and he taught someone who was really disappointed that she couldn't learn from Bill Alexander. Bill Alexander was basically retiring, and this woman was told, like, oh, you can take this class down in Florida from this other guy who teaches the same method. And she believed in Bob Ross to the point that she, like, I guess at one point mortgaged her house to pay for stuff like, you know, the first printing of the first book of The Joy of Painting with Bob Ross. And during that time, he struggled quite a bit to get himself off the ground. Like, you know, that iconic look of the curly hair and everything. He actually had straight hair by nature. He developed that hairstyle because he thought, like, well, if I get a perm, I will, like, never have to cut my hair, and I can save so much money. And so his look was born essentially out of looking for ways to cut corners and save every dime that he could, because I guess he did not have enough money to be able to afford to go to the barber on a regular basis. Which kind of tells you a lot about, like, his financial situation and the shoestring budget. But he believed in what he was doing, and he wanted to paint, and he wanted to spread that to others. And so he starts teaching these classes. And as he was starting to teach his own classes, because this was before he had the PBS show, nobody showed up. Nobody wanted to take his classes. So he would do these free demonstrations in a mall and hope that people would sign up for his classes a few days later and things like that. There's a story I heard that at one of these times, he was teaching class in, like, the Washington, D.C. area is what I read. And just one person showed up. And everyone who's with Bob tells him, oh, you know, we're not doing this whole thing for just one person. Just cancel it. And Bob said, no, this guy showed up. I'm going to teach him. By the end of the class, the guy was so just impressed that he said, look, I'm a businessman. I am going to invest in your company. I can put up $1 million, but you got to sign over 40% of everything you make from this venture. He turned him down. I don't know how a guy who can't afford haircuts turns down an offer of $1 million, but he did. He had some courage to go out traveling the country on this faith that something will pan out. And so then he actually created The Joy of Painting in the early 1980s, and I didn't realize this. It was shot in, like, the living room of a house, the PBS station in, like, Muncie, Indiana, where he was based out of for this. And that's starting the second season on. I think the first season was filmed somewhere else. Like, it might have been the DC area. And it was kind of a flop. It was not well received. And the first season aired once and never again. But then they went looking for another place, and that's where he landed in Indiana. And I guess the station was headquartered in a house, an old house. And so they had a studio in what would have been, like, the living room. And that's where he filmed all of those, you know, the classic black backdrop, him with the easel, three camera setup, was all in what appears to be, like, just a normal Midwestern living room.
Some of those early episodes are kind of jarring. Have you watched those really early ones? Like, some of them have constant, like, circus music in them.
Yes.
I was just like, why is this music here? Because he hadn't, like, dialed the recipe down for the episodes yet. Oh my gosh. It's like, yeah.
And I, I think that's true, but I think, you know, there's something interesting about the way you refer to it, the recipe for those episodes. It was very carefully constructed. As much as he seems so mellow and laid back about everything, when you look at it, there's a very clear and I would say rigid structure to it. Like, he's got that tight setup. He's got the black background, which was actually deliberate. The simplicity of that background, they said they considered different set designs and they landed on that essentially like empty space close up, him and the easel, nothing else, to give it a sense of sort of intimacy. And he's speaking, and he said he's always envisioning just one person he's speaking to. He wanted it to feel like a conversation with a close friend or a family member and not, you know, public speaking. Because you know how your voice and your inflection, everything is different when you're talking to a large crowd compared to when you're talking to an individual.
Yeah. He's got a really interesting combination of strategic thinking and sensitivity to people and animals, I guess. But it really seems like a rare combo, like where, you know, you're really strategizing hard, but also all about the one person all the time, you know?
And I think that's a winning combination. I mean, you know, that person who can make a connection with others and, like you said, the soft spot for animals. I can't believe I didn't even mention this. Growing up, he said he had like every kind of pet that you could imagine. He grew up with a bunch of different small animals and taking them in, because from what I understand reading between the lines, it seems like he grew up without a lot of toys and other stuff. Like, he went out seeking connections and fun in nature and playing with animals and stuff like that, because he didn't have a whole lot else. His father, I think, was a carpenter, and, you know, trained Bob a little bit in that. And actually, that's how, a lot of people don't know this, Bob Ross lost the tip of his index finger when he was young in an accident with a saw. You don't see it too often because it was on his hand that was always holding the palette. But when they have close-ups of the palette, sometimes if you look carefully, you can see he's missing the tip of his index finger.
I forgot that his dad was a carpenter. My dad's a carpenter too.
Oh, so really?
Like, it, yeah, definitely teaches you a lot about practicality and about people. Because if you're a carpenter, sometimes, I mean, my dad was a public facing one, like not just in a cabinet shop, but he would go and work at people's houses, and you gotta solve problems and be nice to people.
And I think that's a really important skill, and I think that's probably why he had the appeal that he did, because I think what's most interesting is, even though Bob Ross was teaching Bill Alexander's method, I mean, almost identical, right? The delivery was 180 degrees difference. Bill Alexander was a very serious, I would say stern person teaching this method. And it was the same techniques, but it was intimidating. You know, it felt like he was yelling at you about painting the right way.
And he also painted outside, which was strange. Well, I don't know if every episode was outside, but the ones I saw, he's just like on the grass next to a forest and the wind's blowing. And it felt like chaotic to me watching it. I'm just like, why he's outside? And it felt kind of too far away and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And tonally, like I said, it was almost as far apart as you could get, except the technique was the same. And you know, Bill Alexander, I guess the outside in nature makes sense if you're thinking we're painting landscapes, we're painting from observation, look at this beautiful scene. But Bob Ross had a different idea, like I said, about that intimacy, that connection between him and one person on the other end who's watching this and one person who's learning from it. And he wanted it to have that connection and an appeal that would last through the ages. So as I said, everything about it was very thoughtfully constructed. He would dress in that same like blue button down because he said he wanted his wardrobe to be timeless. He wanted it to hold up and not seem too dated, which is funny when you look at his hairstyle. I guess he hated that hairstyle. He wished he could get rid of it, but very shortly after he got started, his partners were like, we built the trademark on this. Like, this is your logo. This is your signature. We can't get rid of this. And so I think it grew on him over time, but I think that was probably the one bit about his look and his aesthetic that he probably regretted, at least in the early days. I got to say, I liked it. I like the wonkiness of his hair. You know, it felt like it was the kind of person who does just let it all hang out and you can relate to it. You know, he's this oddball that's on my screen and doing amazing things with the paint. And to me, it just made it a little bit more human and endearing than if he'd had like the military crew cut.
Absolutely. I mean, it made him stick out and easily representable, like the way that the parodies and the just in Halloween costumes have popped up, because it's just all you need is a palette and a afro wig and a paintbrush, and then you can. Everyone knows he's iconic. You know.
Yeah.
He's got that personal brand going. Yeah.
Yeah, and on the topic of that personal brand. He did build a brand beyond the shows. I guess I've seen he really didn't make much of any money directly off his own art. Like he wasn't getting big bucks from public television. I know most people think public TV is what makes a billionaire tycoon, but actually he didn't make much of any money there. And the paintings he made each episode, he would give those to public television stations, donating them so they could sell them and make a bit of money for their annual fundraisers. So really where he made his living was off of, you know, the classes and workshops, the books. Eventually there were the Bob Ross line of art materials. He's selling all of that stuff. The joy of painting, the television show, was basically just a commercial for all the other products and services that he had that he could sell people if they wanted to learn his method and practice and all of that. And it was highly successful, and that's where the rift with him and Bill Alexander came in, because Bill Alexander felt betrayed. I mean, Bill Alexander actually, in the early days, recorded videos and commercials saying, like, I'm passing the torch to my student, Bob Ross, and, you know, so celebratory of that. But then as Bob got into the same business of the classes and the supplies and all of that, they became competitors. And, yeah. You know, Bob actually early on was showing a lot of gratitude, thanking Bill Alexander for teaching him. And then in later interviews, he kind of just stopped mentioning him and said, you know, I'm not going to promote my competitor, which on the one level I get, but if I'm Bill Alexander, I also get why that's really hurtful.
Yeah, I wonder what his internal, there's no way to know this, but what his internal experience was after that separation, like, because it seems like he started getting more business backup as far as strategy and like the cutthroat business stuff, because it didn't seem like he was very cutthroat. He was probably competitive, I would assume. But yeah, it seemed like I wonder if it was painful for him, internally to kind of just give Bill Alexander the cold shoulder later on, you know? Probably. I would hope so.
I imagine it probably was. And I imagine, and this is pure speculation, but yeah. I imagine it was difficult for him because in so many other aspects, Bob Ross seemed like he was genuinely a cool guy. Yeah. You know, all the interviews I've come across of, you know, friends and other ones talking about Bob Ross, they talked about how gentle and how kind and how sweet and how loving he was. When you think about how much he did, like, I mean, he made literally thousands of paintings that he gave away to public television stations so they could auction off. And, you know, he could have sold those, especially as he got bigger and bigger. I'm sure he could have made a decent amount of money off that. But he would give it away. I think the cold shoulder was probably confines of business relationships. Just like he was told, you can't cut that hair. They probably said, you can't talk about Bill Alexander. You know, there were probably the lawyers and everyone who says, like, oh, we don't talk about these people because if you say something about a competitor and that claim cannot be substantiated. You know what I mean? Like, you almost, it's not even like, well, I don't want to give free publicity to a competitor. It becomes like you have to be really careful about what you say about a competitor or you expose yourself to potential lawsuit liabilities.
Yeah, there's like brand distinction stuff and trademarks and not wanting to confuse people with, wait, is Bob Ross Bill Alexander's stuff or is it Bob Ross stuff? You know, yeah. Yeah,
because if he says like, well, I learned everything I know from Bill Alexander, then it creates this like, well, is Bill Alexander endorsing Bob Ross and his products and his workshops? And, you know, like I could see where there could be difficult territory beyond just like, well, I didn't want to give him the publicity. I don't know.
Did you ever receive a Bob Ross like paint set or anything like that? Or buy one?
You know, it's funny. I don't remember ever buying one or receiving one. And yet I know I've had Bob Ross paint. Well, because so when I started painting, with a set that I found in my basement at home as a kid. Like I was a teenager. And so it was like, well, it was probably my mom's or maybe my aunt's or someone else's, or you know what I mean? Like it wasn't stuff that I bought or remember acquiring. It was just like in the house. And it was mostly Winsor & Newton, which I am still a fan of their products if they ever want to send me them. Also, I should probably, for legal reasons, say that I have no affiliation with them after our last conversation about Bob Ross. But I do remember there were at least like one or two Bob Ross tubes in there. They were fine paints, you know.
Yeah, I got a set in like 1997, I think. I was in middle school and I tried painting with it, and it was my first introduction to oil, and it didn't go so great. I don't think. I mean, the format wasn't really for me, but I really appreciate him and his personality and methods. But yeah,
yeah, and just to wrap up a little bit about his personality and I guess his methods. What made him famous was he was doing those paintings literally in half an hour. He would start to finish, just record and talk through making those paintings. And he seemed so chill about it as he's saying like, oh, there are no mistakes, just happy accidents and, you know, the happy little trees and all of that. It's just such a positive, wonderful tone. And he talked about the reason he did that is because, you know, he wants to paint the world that he wants to live in. And he, you know, he said, if you want misery, if you want suffering, if you want violence, go watch the news. But here, it's my happy little world. I want that positive tone. And I personally love someone who's just earnestly putting out that positive vibe. And I think a lot of people responded to that. But the way that he was painting, he would basically cover it like in a wash of paint. So then he's painting into the wet paint. And it can be a very forgiving method in some ways because the paint is all still wet. You can wipe it away if you make a mistake because you're working so directly. But at the same time, it's not really that forgiving working wet on wet. If you don't know what you're doing, everything turns into this muddy mess and it gets harder and harder to fix, as a teenaged Kyle definitely learned the hard way. But he makes it look easy, you know? And there's some truth to it. Like, there is some forgiving. There is a bit that oil can be forgiving working wet on wet. And his techniques really did work. And I think what a lot of people really responded to was the way that he would encourage you to realize that it's not about talent and something that you're born with, but that if you are willing to practice, there are systems and structures and methods that you can learn to achieve something that looks absolutely beautiful. And he would put in a lot of time and effort thinking and planning out. Like, he would make preparatory sketches and he would practice every stroke that he was going to paint before the actual taping. Like, he wasn't making it up as he went along. In an interview, he said, like, he would lay awake in bed just mentally going through every brushstroke that he was going to make for the following day's taping, because of the fact that, like, as laid back as he seemed, in 30 minutes, you have to go from blank canvas to finished work. I can't do that in 30 minutes. I'm relatively quick as a painter, and I am relatively, you know, accepting of all of my giant flaws, but I can't do start to finish in 30 minutes. Not unless I've done it several times.
Yeah, it is magical, but it's like magic that's loaded with a lot of work to make it that quick. Yeah. And I mean, the fact that, I mean, he was just so well versed in like the tricks and the methods, they're very economical methods, like, where once you learn the feel, it doesn't take a lot of time as long as you don't overwork it.
I think that's the thing. You got to know how not to overwork it. And I am one to just beat things to death. So I guess I'm not going to overwork this first segment. We're going to take a short break. And after this, we're going to talk about one of his specific works, Mystic Mountain. Welcome back. Now, I want to take a little bit of time to talk about one of Bob Ross's paintings. So we have this landscape. This is, if you're watching The Joy of Painting, it's from season 20, episode 1. As you're looking at this painting, what's jumping out at you? What are you noticing?
Well, honestly, this one looks a little mushy to me, compared to what I remember of his works, mostly. Yeah. Like the yellow foreground trees look a little splotchy, but maybe it's the low res image, I'm not sure. But but the space created is cool, and the clouds are, and mountains are always very striking, and yeah.
I think what's interesting, looking at across his body of work, this feels very typical of his format and his structure, where it's like you so often see a mountain in the background, clouds around it. You see some middle ground that gets a little bit hazy, and then you see like this foreground of trees and stuff that we're peeking through. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's not like linear perspective, but there is a depth to it, and I can see exactly how he's constructing that depth through the scale of the trees, and like the water gives us this pathway to go deeper into the landscape.
Yeah, it's I mean, they draw you in. Yeah, it's like a you get pulled straight back towards the mountain, and I mean, they're immediate contemplative sort of work that I see the appeal, because like you don't have to come up with complex, you know, ideas or scenes, but it's a kind of painting that gives the viewer space to just be with it, you know, just like nature is, you know. So I guess that kind of its idea, but yeah.
Yeah. And I'm also, now that I'm looking at this a little bit more carefully, I'm noticing almost like there's almost a symmetry to it that I'm finding very sort of soothing. Like as I look at the water, it's roughly like an inversion of the mountain. You know what I mean? Where like at the bottom, where the water comes to a point, it's becoming white, and then because of the reflection of the evergreen trees and stuff like that, it gets a little bit deeper, greenish, gray, sort of near the horizon line, you know? And I think there's something that I find satisfying about that. And the stillness of the water, I think, is also contributing a little bit to that calm, sort of soothing, almost meditative quality to it. And there's something then about the foreground that is driving me absolutely nuts. Are you seeing this too? Like, it almost feels yeah. like it doesn't belong with the extreme, like, yellows and stuff like that.
Well, it's a little redundant because if you look at, like, the vertically middle, there's a couple yellow trees, but then they just keep on coming. Usually, I don't know, the kinds of pieces I remember him having, sometimes he'd have a little bit of a green grassy close foreground, mm-hmm. or maybe like a waterfall or a different kind of tree interrupting, but it looks like it's like very samey in a way that I think a lot of his pieces, they had like one more variety in the foreground, or a fence post, or a, you know, the edge of the water. We don't see, I mean, there's a brown spot at the very bottom, and I can't tell if that's tree or water's edge, but it doesn't seem like water's
edge. It doesn't feel like water's edge to me.
No.
The only place where I see the water's edge is right around the center, where we've got that group of like three coniferous trees, and we see ground, and we see like a little bit of shoreline there. But the extreme foreground, I feel like it's all leaves and bushes and grasses and stuff. And it's, yeah, I think it's too much of it. I think that's why it's bothering me. It also feels thicker textured.
Yeah. You were talking about like the dynamic push and pull of the lights and darks. It's kind of pleasing. And it's just kind of, if you look at the ratio of like where light and dark kind of oscillate, like from sky downward, that those yellow trees, they're kind of just swallowing all the space with very little range of change, you know?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. It's all in roughly the same range. It's interesting because the reason I pulled this specific one is because like when I was looking at his body of work, I'm going to be honest, I became a little bit overwhelmed trying to pick out what would be a good Bob Ross painting, because as I said, there have been thousands and thousands of them. So I let Google decide for me. And so I basically just like Googled best Bob Ross painting or something like that. And this is the one that came out at the top of the list. And I'm like, well, if this is the one that people like, but it feels very meh to me, which I guess is the most common criticism of Bob Ross's work. Like from the art world, there are a lot of people who appreciate Bob Ross for making art accessible and, you know, in our homes and sort of demystifying the process of creation. And at the same time, there are a lot of people who have said it's formulaic, it's kind of kitschy, it's simplified, there's not much passion to it or whatever. I would argue in some ways the lack of passion is kind of the point. I don't even want to say lack of passion, but because there, I think he was passionate about art. It's just like, it's a soothing, gentle tone. It's meant to be peaceful and tranquil and, you know, kind of like the Impressionists. It wasn't meant to be upsetting to people. It was meant to be just soothing and satisfying.
Yeah. Well, I think it's with a lot of art, art that knows what it is and doesn't try to be something it's not is art that I tend to like, I think. And I think despite the formulaic method and, you know, the same kind of stuff over and over again, Bob Ross's pieces are exactly what he wants them to be, you know, like, and I mean, so it doesn't challenge the viewer the way that a lot of modern art tries to, but it is, you know, beauty driven, and it's his personal story, I think, and that people can connect with it, you know, that I mean, nature is striking. Like when you're in a forest and you see this in real life, I mean, you can just sit there and breathe it in. And he's just chasing that over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, I would agree. So I guess to wrap it up, I always ask, where does this piece belong? Is this one for the Louvre, a museum piece to cherish for the ages? Is this one for the lab, one for us to sort of deconstruct and study and learn from, whether we like it or not? Kind of the eat your vegetables of the art world. Or is this one for the loo, British for the bathroom? It's one that maybe has its time and place, but we don't need to dwell on that.
So this is a hard question for me because if I were to isolate the painting as if it were its own, just in a void, apart from the person who created it in the context and his body of work as far as how he innovated television art education, I would be like, I don't think this is museum. And I mean, maybe lab, because the mechanics of his methods are very interesting, because you can learn them. Like I think it's a accessible, like it's like getting a kit of like, but not as, cause paint by numbers are really fun for people to get started with a process. And I think his method is more like a lab driven kind of thing. But again, it's more about the process than the work itself to me, but the work itself is what motivates people to want to know the process. So I guess I'm going with lab on this one. But I don't see this as like a, oh my gosh, this painting is like just moves me to tears. And I wouldn't throw it in the garbage, because people think, oh, well, you know, Bob Ross taught people how to do this method so anyone can do it. But the truth is that he did it in a way that you can see his movements and you can see the little graces of his mark making that are different than if you just learned it, you know, even if you've been practicing for a year and you're getting close, it's still a different, it's a complex process to synthesize all of those micro decisions over and over and over again. And he's still trying to one up himself, I'm sure, till the very end, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And for those listeners who want to be able to sound you know, pretentious as you talk about this stuff. The term we would use there is sprezzatura, for that sort of studied carelessness or that clumsy grace where it's like, you know, you've built up this skill and you just make it seem like it's free flowing and spontaneous and so carefree. I struggled with my own classification on this. I ultimately decided that I was going to go with either the lab or the loo, depending on which way you went. I was going to try to find a way to disagree. I mostly agree with what you're saying there, but I'm actually gonna say the loo, not because I think it's like disposable and garbage, you know. I don't mean this as disrespect. I mean this because I am looking at it as a very sort of process driven. I feel like it's almost like therapeutic, these kinds of landscapes that are so calm and peaceful and soothing, and it's largely about the act of creation as almost a meditative thing. And so I'm putting this not on par with like the you know, sand mandalas or something like that, because it doesn't have quite that level of spiritual significance. But I am going to say, in some ways, I think there is something about this as being just a piece that's meant to be enjoyed for the moment, and then we can let it go. It's about the joy of creation, and it doesn't need to be put up behind glass in a museum preserved for the ages. It's something to enjoy for the afternoon, like going on a hike. You enjoy it for the moment, you take it in, and you move on. And the memory of it may stick with you, but you know, you don't abandon your home to stay on that mountainside.
Yeah, it's like a balance, I'd say, of like the fact that the artist, you know, expresses himself in the work, but I feel like the nature aspect of it is actually heavier than the Bob aspect, right? Like, but I mean, that's what makes it universal, because we all experience nature, and so it's like, yeah, it doesn't feel so like, oh wow, I've never considered this before. It's just kind of like, yeah, wow, this is familiar to me. Like,
yeah,
I've seen this kind of beautiful thing before, and I just love beautiful things.
Yeah, it's nice. It's enjoyable. Yeah,
it's nice.
And then, you know, we can go on to sleep. You know,
I will. To be honest, I was thinking the loo, but I guess I was feeling like, oh, I can't just be ruthless. I was scared to be mean, so. But
I don't think it's necessarily mean to say that something can be, you know, it's got its time and its place, and it doesn't need to be preserved forever. I mean, if you preserve everything, then you're just a hoarder, you know? Like, you have to say that some stuff is elevated and some stuff's enjoyed for a moment. And that's not to say that the momentary pleasures are any lesser. In some ways, the things that we enjoy for the moment, I'd say, are more significant, because that's really the stuff of life. That's the day to day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I tend to be a hoarder, though. So, no.
Yeah, same here.
I keep everything. No. No, but that's true. I think so. Yeah, yeah. Makes sense.
Well, thank you once again, Tom DesLongchamp. It has been such a pleasure getting to know you and your art, and then getting to talk to you about the art that you love as well.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me, and thanks for sharing about my process. Oh, and one fun thing, guess what? I found some brushes in a free pile last year, and I just noticed it on Halloween. I was Bob Ross for Halloween this year.
Yeah.
I've noticed that one of the brushes from that free pile is a Bill Alexander brush. It's got his name on it.
That is too perfect.
And I put duct tape on it to make it not reflect light, you know, like Bob Ross does.
Yeah.
But it was a Bill Alexander brush, which I thought was just layered. It's a perfect costume, you know, like I'm using the original OG painter guy stuff.
I love that. Well, thank you so much once again.
No problem.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.